Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the November 2008 installment of Science News Update. This is Jim Campanella. Tonight's episode and background were inspired by the news of several months ago that we're finally able to reprogram adult cells into becoming stem cells, and de-differentiating, as we say in the business. This is the holy grail of anybody interested in body reconstruction or curing genetic diseases. However, that is old news, and in the last month, a more recent story has appeared that actually makes that original breakthrough mean something. We can now generate those stem cells to be safe for the recipient. The most obvious question is, why were those regenerated stem cells not safe to begin with? What made them such a potential problem? Well, to answer that, we need to look at a bit of genetic history, as well as some SF history. One of the oldest tropes in science fiction is being able to take traits from one organism and place them into another. The grandfather of all this literature is probably The Island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells. If you remember, Moreau does genetic experiments to alter animals and give them human characteristics. Both the book and movie are chilling, although for very different reasons. The movie is scary based on Marlon Brando's scenery chewing, but now is not the time for that. That story from 1896 predated by about 30 years the first scientific experiment that demonstrated that you really could transfer traits from one organism to another. In 1926, Dr. Frederick Griffith was hired by the British government to make a vaccine to prevent pneumonia infections in the Spanish flu influenza pandemic after World War I. The idea was to use two strains of Streptococcus pneumonia bacteria to help do this. You may remember this flu as being the super flu bug that the media goes on about every year during the flu season and scaring the hell out of old ladies and anybody with kids. Anyway, Griffith had two strains of bacteria that he was working with. First, a smooth strain, called the S strain, that had a complex sugar coating around it and was virulent and deadly when injected into mice, or humans for that matter. The bacteria caused pneumonia and killed mice in a day or two. The sugar coating was not rock candy, it's a slimy layer called a capsule. It covers the cell's surface and allows the bacteria to resist the immune system. The second strain that Griffith used was called the rough strain, or the R strain, and this did not have a capsule and thus did not cause pneumonia when injected into the mice, and that's because the immune system found those cells quickly and easily and killed them. Now, this is the experiment. Try to follow. It's a bit confusing without pictures now. First, Griffith injected the smooth strain of bacteria into mice, and the mice all died, as you would expect. Second, Griffith injected the rough strain into mice, and all these mice survived, again, as you'd expect. Now comes the really confusing part. Third, Griffith took the smooth, nasty strain and boiled it to kill it. Then he injected the nasty, dead strain into mice, and ta-da, they all lived. So, well, this proved if you kill a bacteria, it can't infect you. Well, that is common sense, but is it entirely true? The fourth experiment is where most people would say that Griffith kind of went off the rails. He took the dead, nasty, smooth bacteria and injected them into mice with the live, rough bacteria. And all the mice died. This was a bit of a surprise to Griffith, who had expected them to live, but he was even more surprised when he did an autopsy and found live smooth bacteria in the blood of the dead mice. This made no sense to him, since he did not put smooth, virulent bacteria into the mice. The only way that it could make sense was if somehow the dead bacteria had altered the live bacteria and changed them into smooth bacteria. And not only did that appear to be the case, but the change seemed to be permanent in the bacteria. Griffith hypothesized that some transforming principle, as he called it, from the heat-killed smooth strain converted the rough strain into the virulent smooth strain. It was later demonstrated in another famous experiment that this so-called transforming principle was actually DNA. This is what happened in that experiment. When the smooth bacteria died, they released their DNA. That DNA was ingested by the rough bacteria, incorporated into the rough bacteria's DNA, used as their own DNA, and then they became smooth bacteria. This process is called transformation. It's the entire basis for genetic engineering and the creation of recombinant organisms of just about any kind. Nowadays, we can transform almost any organism. Bacteria are easy. I do that in my lab every day. Yeast are also pretty easy. Many of the fruits and vegetables that you buy at the grocery store are recombinant and carry genes to protect them as they're growing against pests, disease, frost, flood, heavy metals, heat. We've even been able to add additional nutrient genes into plants that traditionally didn't have them. The best example of that is golden rice, which contains beta-carotene. Beta-carotene is the precursor for vitamin A. That rice is going to save a huge proportion of the underdeveloped world's population from malnutrition-induced blindness. By the way, those of you in the Green Party may rage against genetic engineering of plants and animals, but after 20 years, there is still little evidence that suggests that any GMO is dangerous. I will leave it there before I induce loud yelling and screaming in my audience. To continue, we've even been able to alter animal genetic makeup. One of the common ways of doing this with mice and other higher animals is to take egg cells from those species, treat them directly with the DNA that we want taken up into the genome. Then, when the egg is fertilized and the animal grows up, they have a copy of the gene in their DNA, in all the cells of their body, essentially. I'm seriously simplifying this, but that's essentially what's done. Now you're saying, yes, but on the TV show Heroes, they can just inject grown adults with some mysterious substance and they get superpowers. Haven't we gotten that yet? Can we alter the genomes of adult humans? Yeah, okay. First, Heroes is one of those shows that makes scientists grit their teeth and keep repeating, it's just for entertainment. Calm down before you burst a blood vessel. No, there are no drugs or chemicals known that can alter anyone's genome permanently. Well, at least to any good end. There are lots and lots of chemical mutagens that act randomly and never with any good results. Second, geneticists have been trying for the last 10 years to come up with a good way to transform grown humans, and we've had lots of problems along the way. The first problem that you'll have if you want to transform any grown animal with a new gene is there are lots and lots of cells in an adult. If you inject DNA into somebody's arm, that DNA will stay localized and will be very unlikely to do them much good. If, for example, they're diabetic and need that DNA in their pancreas. The same thing, if they have a neurologic disease, that DNA will stay in their arm and not go to their brain. It's much easier to change the DNA of a human just after fertilization has occurred, or even before fertilization. But there are still moral issues there that many of us have. And anyway, from a practical standpoint, we're talking about getting DNA into a grown human, not into an embryo. Second problem, it never seems very permanent. The gene expression seems to consistently go away after a short time. I hate to bring up Heroes again, but I really thought that when Suresh injected himself with that compound in season 2 there, that it would only be temporary, that he would not have a permanent alteration in his genome. I was wrong, obviously. I should know better than to expect reality from a show pretty much created based on comics. But getting back on track here. Third problem. Not all disorders can be cured by giving people single genes. Some disorders are way more complex than that. At any rate, researchers have been trying to come up with solutions to these problems for a while. They decided that the best way to move the target DNA around somebody's body permanently would be to use viruses as carriers. Yes, you heard right, viruses. And not just any viruses, but retroviruses. For those of you who do not know, the most famous retroviruses are herpes and HIV. Good plan? Well, it appeared so at the time. Retroviruses can spread easily and have the ability to place their DNA into your chromosomes. This process of human transformation was called gene therapy. It was a wonderful idea, but, well, it didn't take long for the plan to blow up completely in their faces. In 1999, 18-year-old Jesse Gelsinger came into the spotlight and demonstrated just how far we needed to go. Jesse was participating in a gene therapy trial for ornithine transcarboxylase deficiency, OTCD. By the way, with treatments, this is a non-fatal genetic disease and did not threaten Jesse's welfare. The viral vector that he was given was supposed to give him a good copy of the OTC gene and make him no longer need treatment and feel better. It didn't. He died from multiple organ failures 4 days after starting the treatment. His death is believed to have been triggered by a severe immune response to the virus that carried the DNA he was given. In January of 2003, the FDA placed a halt on all gene therapy trials using retroviral vectors in blood stem cells. They took that action after they learned that a second child treated in a French gene therapy trial had developed a leukemia-like condition, presumably as a result of the treatment. The child had actually been successfully treated in 2002 for severe combined immunodeficiency disease, but the cancer developed within a year. By April of 2003, the FDA was overseeing any gene therapy trials using retroviral vectors very closely. Because human trials have been very limited by the FDA in the last 5 years, not a lot of progress has been made in human gene therapy methodology. This takes us full circle back to the original point of this whole article. A year ago, it was reported by two separate research teams. One led by Shinya Yamanaka at Kyoto University in Japan, and one led by James Thompson and Yunying Yu at the University of Wisconsin. Both groups had engineered human skin cells to express 4 different genes. For reasons unclear to scientists, exposing those cells to those active genes appeared to turn back the developmental clock. Both groups found that the resulting cells exhibited 2 major properties that define embryonic stem cells. First, they were pluripotent. Pluripotent means that they could develop into any type of cell in the body. And second, they could divide apparently indefinitely in their undifferentiated state. Everyone got very excited about this because it was evidence that we could engineer adult cells into embryonic stem cells without any ethical issues. And we could grow huge amounts of these cells. There was only one flaw. They were transformed with a retrovirus. A retrovirus that embeds its DNA randomly into the cell's DNA and can eventually induce cancer. That's not a good thing for cells that you want to help people with and you want to actually place in their bodies. In the last 2 months, scientists at Harvard University have found a way to affect the same reprogramming without using a harmful virus, a method that paves the way for tissue transplants made from a patient's own cells. Dr. Konrad Hochatlinger and his colleagues at Harvard University reported in the September 25th issue of the journal Science that an entirely different type of virus, an adenovirus, can make the DNA transfer into mouse cells without permanently integrating itself into the mouse DNA. The virus just dumps the DNA into the cell, where it's able to reprogram the cell with 4 growth-regulating genes. The DNA is expressed, then degraded along with the virus after the reprogramming. The resulting cells can divide indefinitely as stem cells, but show no trace of the virus, just a temporary infection that disappears within a short time. And that is why they're safe. This is a seriously fantastic breakthrough. Some people have predicted that these new stem cells may become regenerative medicine's magic bullet. If they turn out to be as potent as embryonic stem cells, they could be used to help regrow tissues damaged in conditions from paralysis to Parkinson's disease to diabetes. If they can be grown from a patient's own cells, they could furthermore be transplanted without triggering an immune response and rejection. Imagine regrowing new parts in a tank or by a printing process. New hearts, new kidneys, new livers, new nervous tissues. Even fresh new ovaries for women past menopause who still want to get pregnant or just want to retain their youthful levels of female hormones. Heck, you could push this into the realm of the very speculative and even predict, with a bit of minor tweaking to the process, that male to female transsexuals will even be able to get that uterus and the ovaries they've always desired. If you listen to my news report from last month, you know I was talking about the breakthrough in gene sequencing that's coming in the next couple of years. The combination of gene sequencing and the ability to program an unlimited supply of your own stem cells is going to change medicine forever. It will be a very changed world, ladies and gentlemen. To quote from Miranda in Shakespeare's Tempest, "Oh wonder, how many goodly creatures are there here! How beauteous mankind is! Oh brave new world! that hath such people in it. All that I can hope is that we do not live to see those words as the dark, ironic ones that Aldous Huxley envisioned. Only time will tell. Well, thanks for listening. As always, take care, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella. P.S. This is an update on my September news report on erasing memories. I told you it was coming 2 months ago, and things are moving even faster than I predicted. Joe Sien, a neurobiologist at the Medical College of Georgia, created a mouse in which he could activate or inhibit sensitivity to the neural enzyme alpha-CAM kinase 2. This is not one of the enzymes I discussed last month, by the way. His research group reports in the October 15, 2008 issue of Current Biology that he can selectively and permanently delete memories from a mouse. Yes, specific memories, not random ones as in the system that I reported last month. Sien says that they have barely stepped foot onto the mountain that is human memory. But things are certainly moving along, even if we haven't moved very far yet.